And it is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, reminding you right away that if you have a financial question for Bruce or Peg or anyone at Wealth Enhancement, you can call this number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and someone will get back to you. That number is 1-888-6-ADVICE. You can also always email questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. But for the next little bit here, we invite you to be part of the program at 651-461-9226. Here is the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor, Bruce Helmer. Hello to you, Bruce.
Hello, Susie Jones. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for asking. And Peg is getting a well-deserved day off today. Hey, before we get into the topic, I'm just curious. Okay. Are you a fan of the Olympics? Have you been watching the Olympics?
I have. It's on in the studio, and sometimes it's hard to concentrate on what I'm doing in front of me because unusual and strange things are happening, and amazing feats of strength as we watch men's gymnastics are on right now. Yeah, it's amazing. It is just their strength and muscles and endurance, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I have to admit, historically, I haven't been a huge Olympics fan. I'm a sports fan, but for whatever reason, I never really was, you know, gravitated a lot towards the Olympics. But this year's, I've been watching it a lot, and I gotta say, I'm mesmerized. I mean, you're watching, you know, a swimming race where there's hundredths of a second between, you know, first and fifth, and that's just exciting.
Amazing. Yeah, so we're
it really is.
Our hats off to all those athletes from around the world, and we've got some great Minnesotans showing up as well.
Yeah, the local connection's interesting too, yep. So, Susie, what I wanted to talk about today, what are the things that happens, one of the mistakes that I see a lot as people get older is they get too conservative too quickly. They're getting close to retirement, or maybe they've just retired, and they say, gosh, I can't afford to take investment risk anymore. I can't afford to have a year like 2008 or even a year like 2022 where the value of my retirement plan, you know, went way down. I don't have time to recover. I'm in retirement. I need to spend that money. I can't afford to have it go down. So they want to move all their money into investments with no risk of principal. And while it is appropriate to reduce risk as we get older, and it is appropriate to reduce our exposure to stocks as we get older, to get out of stocks completely and to go to all fixed income investments for most people is probably going to be a mistake, because if the rate of return doesn't keep pace with inflation aggregately on all of your money, you're actually going to lose purchasing power. You can put money in an interest-bearing account today and say, I'm making 4.5% with no risk. And I agree, after years and years and years of not making any money on our safe money, now we do, and that's a good thing. But if the inflation rate is 5, and I'm not saying it is right now, but if the inflation rate is higher than whatever you're earning on your investments, your purchasing power actually goes backward. So I think when people think of risk, they automatically think of risk of principal on my money. But I think of risk as risk of what if I run out of money before I die? I need a rate of return that's high enough that I can maintain my lifestyle that might include increases in my cost of living because there is inflation and prices don't stay the same. So I still probably always need some exposure to stocks. So today what I wanted to talk about is reducing risk, but doing it efficiently, doing it wisely, and not just, you know, not getting too conservative too fast, because most people throughout their life still want or should have some exposure to stocks. So let me dig in a little deeper on that. So one of the things that that in our industry we talk a lot about is risk tolerance. And I don't want to ignore somebody's risk tolerance. If somebody says to me, I don't want to take risk, I have a low risk tolerance, I can't sleep at night if my account balance goes down, I have to take that seriously, and I have to try to walk in that client's shoes, put myself in their place. But I also have to advise them on the realities. I frequently, Susie and listeners over the years, I've had people say to me, I don't want to take any risk. But then when I do future value forecasting and I say, okay, well, if we don't have any risk and it's all in these interest bearing accounts, they're going to run out of money in their mid 70s. And so when I tell them that, then suddenly they, even though they realize they have a low risk tolerance, they realize they need to take some risk to get the return on investment that they need so that they don't run out of money before they pass away. And, you know, risk tolerance has always been such a subjective thing anyway. You know, if you're going to grade somebody's risk tolerance on a scale of 1 to 10, I've never quite been able to determine how a 7 differs from a 6 or how a 7 differs from an 8. It's a very subjective thing. So it's certainly something that we need to consider. But at the end of the day, my investment advice or how we invest in my client is really based on what rate of return do we need to achieve for you to meet your goals and objectives. And it's different for everybody. Everybody has different goals and objectives. What age do you want to retire? What kind of lifestyle do you want after you retire? Do you want to travel? Do you want a second home? Do you want to snowbird in the winter? Do you want to tithe to your church? Do you want to give to other charities? Do you want to help children and grandchildren financially? All these things come into play, and I need to understand this about my client so I can advise them properly. But whatever those goals and objectives are, based on your core values, we want to invest such that we get the return on investment that you can meet those goals and objectives, retire when you want to, with the lifestyle that you want, but to do it with the least amount of risk possible. It has been suggested to me before that I push stocks on people too much. And the reality is I don't. I've had, just within the last 18 months, I've had several occasions where I've advised clients not to put money in the stock market with me. I have a really good story of a client several months ago. Came in, he had an appointment with me, and I didn't know what he wanted. I thought it was just a typical review meeting. And he had a check, a cashier's check for $180,000. He had sold his home, and he didn't need the net proceeds because he was going to go into a senior living facility that was a rental. And so he wanted to invest this $180,000 with me. I talked him out of it. He said, well, what should I do with it then? And I said, well, look, I'm not going to name the bank, but in the lobby of my office building, there's a bank where I bank. I said, look, I just opened an account down there. They offer a 5% interest rate on a high yield money market if it's new money that's not already deposited with their bank. And he's like, well, how long is the rate guaranteed for? And I said, well, it's not. It could change any time. He goes, you mean it could go down tomorrow? I go, sure. He goes, well, I don't like that. And I go, well, but you're not obligated to leave your money there either. So if the interest rate goes down to a rate that you don't like, then you can come back upstairs and invest it with me if you want to. But so I literally walked him down and introduced him to my personal banker down there, and he opened an account in the bank. My point is, this particular client did not need more stock exposure. The stock exposure that he already had was appropriate for his goals and objectives and his desired rate of return, that I didn't want him to take additional risk at this point in his life. And he's 78 years old. I had another client several years ago. I'll call him John. His name really was John. Sometimes I use John, you know, as an amalgam or my placeholder in a story. This client's name really was John. John came in, and I think it was 2020. I don't remember what year it was, but it was after the presidential election. And again, it's a presidential election year this year, and I still got people losing their minds if the wrong candidate wins. And I'll come back to that later, but calm down, settle down. The market doesn't automatically crash if your candidate or your political party doesn't win in a presidential election year. But John, the wrong person won the election, and John was convinced the sky was falling. And oh my gosh, the market's going to crash. And how are we going to survive? Should I move to another country? I'm like, John, settle down. And I spent 20 or 30 minutes telling him why I thought the market was actually going to do well. I don't think I convinced him, but after spending all this time giving him all the reasons why I was bullish, I advised him to start to reduce equity exposure, to start to divest out of equities. And he said, what are you talking about? You just told me you're bullish on the stock market. We've just been talking for a half an hour, and you've been trumpeting how well you think the market's going to do. You're contradicting yourself. Why would you tell me to get out of the market if you think it's going to do well? And I said, John, just because I think the market's going to do well doesn't mean you need to take that much risk. The rate of return that we've gotten together over the years since we've been working together, we've hit the bogey. We determined if you ever get to X, you're never going to be able to spend all the money you've got. Well, you've surpassed X. John, you won the race. You broke the tape first. The race is over. You won. The only thing that can hurt you now is if you run backwards down the track. So we want to reduce your risk. I am bullish on the stock market. I'm keeping my money in the stock market. But that's not the same advice I'm giving to you, not at this point. So we divested quite a bit out of the market. John came back in for his review the following year, and the market did really well, as I thought it would, and he gave me a hard time for getting him out of the market. And I said, John, I told you the market was going to go up, but we still did the right thing because we did not need that additional risk in your situation. So I've also many times over my career, I shouldn't say many, but on occasion, I'll have a review meeting with a client, and they will express disappointment with their return on investment with us. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. Why are you disappointed? Well, I only made 9% and the S&P 500 made 10. And I'm making up these numbers. But things like this have happened over the years. And I'm like, well, you know, you're comparing an apple to an orange. The investments that we have with you are broadly diversified in stocks and bonds and real estate, gold and silver and other precious metals, commodities, cash, and you're comparing to an index that is all stock, and in fact, all one type of stock. It's all domestic large cap stock, and in our portfolio, we've got you in a lot of different things. If you compare our portfolio to the fair apples to apples benchmark, it's actually outpaced its benchmark. Did we beat the S&P 500? No, but I wasn't trying to. I was trying to get you the rate of return that you need, whatever that bogey is, and I want to do it with the least amount of risk possible, and we're doing that. So almost every time when I've had these, over the years, these concerns or complaints about performance, when I put it back in perspective in terms of what we're trying to do and we focus on the fair comparison, the client quickly calms down and realizes they were overreacting or comparing the wrong things. So how do we reduce our risk? When we get to the point where we should reduce our risk, how do we do it? And when should we start to reduce our risk? So Susie and listeners, I always talk to clients about what our investment priorities are. And when we're younger, almost everybody, the top priority should be growth for the future. So if you've got a 401k plan or some other type of retirement plan, and you're in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, heck, maybe even your 50s, growth should be your top priority. And the asset allocation that we use in those years is going to be more aggressive than later on in life as the time horizon gets shorter. But as we get older, as we get closer to retirement, or maybe we're in retirement, maybe growth is not the top priority anymore. Maybe preservation in our mid-50s and early 60s, maybe we want to preserve what we've got. Yes, we still want some growth, but it's not as important as protecting what we've earned. And then in retirement, in our mid-60s and later, or whenever we're retired, I might add a goal of income. Now our retirement plan or our investments, all this money that we've been saving and investing for 25, 30, 35 years, where we're looking for this growth, now we want to turn it into a paycheck for the rest of our lives. I'm not working anymore, and I need money from my investments to maintain my lifestyle, to live the way that I want. So maybe now my priorities are income, number one, preservation, number two, I still don't want to lose what I have, but number three, I still need some growth, but perhaps at this point, it's not the top priority. So what are some of the ways then that we can reduce our risk as we get older and as it becomes appropriate to reduce our risk. So one of the things I always talk about, and this is something we do for all of our clients, is what we would call proactive management. So we start off with what we think is an efficient asset allocation. And again, we believe in diversification. Don't put all of your eggs in one basket. There's, you know, all kinds of terms, negative correlation. We have this asset class and this asset class that have typically historically react opposite of one another. And we own them both because we don't know which one will do better in the short term. So we might want stocks and we might want bonds because they have negative correlation. Usually if stocks do well, then bonds don't. And if bonds do well, then stocks don't. There can be exceptions to that. 2022 was an exception to that. Stocks and bonds both took it on the chin in 2022. But most of the time, there'll be negative correlation. So we start with efficient asset allocation, and then we have proactive management, meaning we're going to make changes from time to time to that portfolio. And a lot of times these changes, again, especially as you get older, is going to be to reduce risk, not necessarily to enhance returns. We might be trying to reduce risk. So when we talk about proactive management and tweaking the portfolio and making changes, one of the reasons that we'll make changes to a portfolio, and we use a strategy called rebalancing. Now, rebalancing, I think, Susie and listeners, is pretty universally accepted in the investment world as an efficient strategy. I'll explain what it is in a second. Now, when you rebalance, I always say everybody agrees that we should rebalance, but nobody agrees as to when is the perfect time to do it. But rebalancing, simply said, here's an example. Let's say, and in the real world, by the way, it's never quite this simple. But let's say my asset allocation is 50-50. I've got 50% of my money in asset class A and 50% of my money in asset class B, and I have $20,000. So I have $10,000 in A and $10,000 in B. The first year out of the gate, let's say, and again, I'm using nice round numbers to make the example easy in the real world. It's never quite this simple, but it doesn't change the reality of my example. So asset class A, the first year, loses half of its value, and my $10,000 shrinks to $5,000. Asset class B doubles, and my $10,000 grows to $20,000. So now, after a year, my $20,000 has grown to $25,000. But in the second year, the exact opposite happens, and asset class B loses half of its value, so the $20,000 shrinks back to $10,000, and A doubles, so the five grows back to 10. That strategy is what a lot of Americans do. It's called buy and hold. You go 50-50 in your two asset classes, and you just ride it out. Well, in this example, after 2 years, I'm flat. I didn't make any money. Buy and hold really doesn't work, even though millions of people and many of you listening to me right now, that's what you do. That's not the most efficient strategy. Another strategy is chasing the hot asset class. Millions of people do this. So again, same example, 10,000 and 10,000 in A and B. First year out of the gate, A loses half of its value. B doubles. This investor says, why do I have that money in A? I lost half of my money. A stinks. I'm getting that $5,000 out of A, and I'm putting it into B, where I doubled my money last year. But the second year, B loses half of its value. A doubles, but I don't have any money in A. I took it all out of there. So my $25,000 that was in B is now $12,500. This investor's lost $7,500 over 2 years. That's a negative 37.5% rate of return on investment. So chasing the hot asset class, which many of you try to do, does not work because you're buying high and selling low, which is the opposite of what you want to do. You want to buy low and sell high. So what if I rebalanced? Again, 10,000 in A, 10,000 in B. First year out of the gate, A loses half of its value, B doubles. And now I look at my portfolio and I say, the ideal asset allocation for me was 50-50. I'm not 50-50 anymore. I got 5,000 in A and 20,000 in B. How do I get back to 50-50? How do I rebalance? Well, I take $7,500 out of B and I put it into A. Now I have $12,500 in A and B. Second year, A doubles to 25,000. B loses half of its value to 6,250. But now after 2 years, I'm sitting at 31,250 and I made $11,250. Rebalancing is a strategy that assures that we're buying low and selling high, which is what we want to do. But so often we're driven by emotion and we want to buy the thing that just went up, which is exactly the wrong time to buy it. So, Susie, I'm keeping an eye on the clock. There's a couple other things I definitely want to talk about today.
Okay.
But we also want to get listeners involved in the second half of the show. But I'm talking about, again, ways to efficiently reduce your risk. And the first one that I've been focusing on is what we call proactive money management. But I got a couple more that I'll share. And then I'll get as many questions in from listeners in the second half of the show also.
All right, very good. You are listening to Your Money. Bruce Helmer is your guest. The number to call for the next half an hour is 651-461-9226. Again, 651-461-9226. You can always email questions as well if you don't feel like being part of the show this next half hour, and that email is yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. You can also write this number down, 1-888-6-ADVICE, if you have a question you want to reach out to the company a little bit later and get your question answered, 1-888-6-ADVICE. We're back after this short break. Welcome back to the second half of Your Money. The number to call right now is 651-461-9226. I'll say it once again. 651-461-9226. We're talking to the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor, Bruce Helmer. Welcome back. And we're talking about risk tolerance and rebalancing our accounts. This is a lot of good information, Bruce. So you want to, before we get to some questions, sort of wrap up what you were saying, and then we'll see if we can get a few questions online.
Yeah, I absolutely would love questions. Excuse me. But I do a couple other things I wanted to hit. Again, I was too verbose in the first half of the show, and I didn't get to one of the main things I wanted to get to. Thanks, listeners, for hanging in there with us. If you did join us late, as Susie mentioned, we're talking about reducing your risk efficiently. And some of the things that we talked about is, number one, the investment goal, to my way of thinking, I think if you ask a lot of people, what's your goal? They'll say, well, I want to get the best rate of return I can. And for me as an advisor, that's literally never the goal. The goal that I have for my clients is to get the rate of return that you need to be successful, however you define success. And I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about what that means, what you're trying to accomplish, when do you want to retire, what your lifestyle looks like, and so on. And then when we know where you're trying to get, we can do future value forecasting, and we can ascertain the rate of return that you need to get, or the what I like to call the bogey, for you to be successful. And I want to hit that bogey with the least amount of risk possible. That said, when you're younger, in your 20s, 30s, 40s, maybe even early 50s, you should be focused on growth. And focusing on growth means all of the money, or most of the money on your retirement plan, is exposed to stocks. But as we get older, as we get close to retirement, maybe our priority shifts from growth to preservation, making sure we don't lose what we have. And then maybe we even, when we're retired, we want income off of this portfolio. So I'm going to recommend very different investments if the goals are income and preservation as opposed to growth. So we talked, how do we achieve this preservation and this income? How do we reduce our risk effectively without trying to time the market, without saying, okay, I think market's going to go down, so I'm going to get out. Okay, now I think it's going to go up, so I'm going to get back in. There's a mountain of data that suggests that that doesn't work. And I don't want to get completely out of stocks, because then I'm reducing my risk of principal, but I'm increasing the risk that I run out of money before I die because my ROI, my return on investment, is too low and it doesn't keep pace with how much money I need to spend. So we talked about broad diversification. We talked about proactive management as a subset of proactive management. We talked about rebalancing. But everything I've talked about so far to reduce your risk assumes that we're going to reduce our exposure to stocks. And there are ways, there are strategies available to reduce your risk, but still keep exposure to stocks and still keep exposure to most of that upside of the market. And many people that try to do this on their own, and even a lot of people that might work with an advisor, might not be aware of some of these strategies. So here's why this is so important. Let's presume that we have a strategy that reduces our risk by 10%, that reduces our downside risk by 10%. And I will tell you that there are strategies that do this. And in the radio show, the complexity involved, it's too hard to go into the details. But just if you accept my premise that this is doable, that we can reduce your risk by 10%, but still keep you exposed to most of the upside of the market. If you could do that, would that be something that would interest you? And I think everyone listening, I think, you know, 10 people out of 10 would say, yeah, that would interest me. And here's why it's so important. If we can do that, let's say that you invest $100,000 into the market and you did it in a right before a bad year in the market, right at the beginning of 2022, right at the beginning of 2008, and you put in your $100,000, and at the end of a year, it's worth $80,000. You lose 20% in the first year. And that sounds awful, but it's possible, and it's happened before. In the short term, the market can retract that much in a given year. It has, and it can again. There is risk in investing in stocks. I've never not disclosed that to clients. So now you're sitting there at $80,000. Now, most people, if I ask them, Susie and listeners, okay, now you're at $80,000. What return on investment do you need to get back to even, to get back to $100,000? Most people, without really thinking it through, will say, well, 20%. If I lost 20%, I need to make 20%. But that's not true. If I make 20% on $80,000, I get back to $96,000. I'm still $4,000 underwater. To get back to $100,000 with my $80,000, I have to make a 25% rate of return to recapture that 20% I lost in the first year. Well, what if we had a strategy that mitigated our risk by 10%, so that instead of losing 20%, we only lost 10? I mean, I shouldn't say only. Nobody's happy with a 10% loss, but it's a heck of a lot better than a 20% loss. So now after 1 year, I'm sitting at $90,000. Now what return on investment do I need to get back to even? It's only about 11.2% to get back to even. So that 10% reduction of risk is a huge deal. And we can do it and still keep market exposure. We don't have to give up all the upside potential by getting out of stocks. So when we talk about reducing risk, when we talk about preserving what we have and converting to income, there's any number of strategies, diversification, proactive management, reducing your exposure to stocks. But there's also strategies available by maintaining your exposure to stocks and maintaining most of your upside on the portfolio, but you can greatly reduce your risk. And these are the types of things that we show clients. These are the types of things, Susie and listeners, I do in my own life. In fact, I'll close with this story and then we'll get listeners involved. And by the way, your question doesn't have to be on reducing investment risk. It can be any financial question you want. But I'll close with this. So I've talked on the show, you know, not infrequently. I don't make a secret of my age. I'm in my mid-60s. And so in January of this year, I took what's called an in-service distribution from my company 401k and moved it to an individual retirement account. And the reason I did that is one of these strategies that I coach clients on for reducing risk was available to me in an individual retirement account, but there was not anything like that available to me in my 401k plan. And I have a really good 401k plan. I'm not complaining about my 401k, But there were opportunities available to me in an individual retirement account that were not in the 401k. Because I'm in my mid-60s, I want to reduce my risk also. I follow the same advice I would give a client. Now, I'm not going to retire anytime soon, but I don't want the same risk in my mid-60s that I was willing to take in my mid-50s. So I'm reducing my risk, just like I often coach my clients to do, but I'm doing it by not completely getting out of stocks and going all into fixed income investments. I'm doing it with some of these strategies where I can keep exposure to the stock market, but reduce my downside. So I practice what I preach, and these are the types of things that we coach our clients to do. So again, listeners, there are ways of reducing your risk as you get older, and it's appropriate in most cases to reduce your risk as you get older, but it's also appropriate for most people at every age, even when you're retired, to keep some exposure to stocks so that your aggregate return on all of your money, A, keeps up with purchasing power and inflation, and B, you need enough return so that you don't run out of money before you run out of breath. But I never want anybody to take risk unnecessarily to have exposure to stocks or any investment with risk of principal if you don't need that return to achieve your goals and objectives. And I think that's the key message. And Susie, I'll break there and we'll let listeners take us home.
Okay, very good. Again, it is 651-461-9226. You can call that number and ask Bruce directly, or you can text us at 651-461-9226. A texter writes this morning, "Good morning, Bruce. What do you think of index annuities as part of your retirement income stream?"
So let me start with the second word of those two words, annuities. Annuities are fairly controversial, and there's several reasons why that's true. They're controversial because they can be very difficult for the investor to understand, and there's definitely some potential disadvantages unique to annuities that you don't have those same disadvantages in other investments. But there's also some potential advantages to annuities. They can do some things for investors that other investments can't do. So annuities themselves are neither good nor bad. It depends upon the investor. And again, their goals and objectives and their risk tolerance, their liquidity needs is a big one. So two of the big potential disadvantages of annuities, potential. This is not true of all annuities. But the two disadvantages that I see most frequently, well, I'll say three disadvantages. Number one, the complexity. They confuse people. Number two, there might be higher costs, or what we call a higher expense drag on annuities than other investments. And number three, you're usually going to sacrifice some liquidity because annuities usually have a deferred sales charge or a back-end load where they restrict your access to your money. But in return for those disadvantages, annuities might provide some reduction in risk, which we've been talking about all day today. They might provide some guaranteed income, not unlike a pension plan. So you have to look and say, if I'm considering an annuity, what are the pros? What are the cons? Do I think the good things outweigh the bad? I want you to make a fully informed decision. As an advisor, it's my job to demonstrate if somebody's considering an annuity, here's what I don't like about it. Here's what I do like about it. And at the end of the day, then the client has to make the decision. Am I willing to put up with these bad things in order to get these good things that I'm attracted to and that I want? The term indexed on the front of that means, And this is a really good question for the topic today in terms of reducing my risk. So on an indexed annuity, Susie and listeners, I need to back up before I go forward and talk about indexing. Annuities historically came in two broad categories. I could either invest in a fixed interest investment like a money market with no risk of principal and no risk of my account balance going backwards. That's called a fixed income annuity or fixed interest annuity. Or I could buy something or invest in something called a variable annuity that has equity sub accounts with exposure to the stock market So there is risk of principal because the stock market could retract or go backwards. So there's more upside, but there's also more risk. Historically, variable annuity, fixed interest annuity. The indexed annuity that the texter asks about is almost like a hybrid between those two, because on an indexed annuity, I basically have a fixed interest annuity with money market type rates, but part of my money, part of my interest earnings goes to buying options on various stock or equity indexes. So if I have an option on an index, the option is the opportunity to invest into that index, but not the obligation to do so. So essentially what happens is if I have an option on index ABC, and over the course of a year that index appreciates in value, I can exercise that option and I can get some of the upside of that index. I said some of the upside. I'll come back to that. But if that index goes down in value, I can let my option expire worthless and I don't lose any money because I was never really in the index. I just had the option to be and I chose not to. Now, this sounds pretty good. I can be, if the market goes up, I participate in the upside, but if it goes down, I don't. So again, I've mitigated risk, which is what I've been talking about all day. But the trade-off is I am going to sacrifice some of my upside because these indexes that I'm investing in will have one of two things to limit the upside. And this is the trade-off on the annuity to get to reduce your risk. You're going to reduce your upside. There will either be a cap, which is the maximum you can earn on that index. So I'm just going to make up a number. If the cap is 8% and the index is up 6, I get 6. If the index is up 8, I get 8. But if the index is up 25, I still only get 8 because that's my cap. I can't get more than the cap. And you might say, well, that stinks. I could have had 25% and I only got 8. But if that index goes down, you don't lose money because you have an option. You're not actually in that index. So there's either a cap or what they call a spread. A spread might be the percent, the first, let's say the index is up 2% and the spread is 2%. You wouldn't make any money. You would be flat. The spread covers the annuity company's cost and the first 2% goes to the annuity company. But once you cover the spread, then you get all the upside. So if the spread is 2% and the index makes 10, you get 8. If it makes 12, you get 10. So you have to cover the spread, or you have a maximum cap, so you don't get all of the upside of the index, but you also don't get any of the downside. So the texter said, is this a good idea? And my answer is, for some people it is, for some people it isn't. Now, I don't want to oversimplify this or paint with too broad of a brush, but if you're an investor that says, I have high risk tolerance, I'm not bothered by market risk, and or I want my money to be liquid, I don't want to tie it up with any restrictions, you would not be a good candidate for an annuity. But if you're somebody that said, I don't need complete liquidity on my money, I know I need exposure to stocks, because if I don't have exposure to stocks, my rate of return will be too low and I'll run out of money before I die, but I'm terrified of a big down year in the market, you might be a good candidate for an annuity. But it should never be an all or nothing thing. I would never tell anybody to put all of their money into an annuity, and I would probably never tell anybody not to put any of their money into an annuity. It can be a tool that's part of a comprehensive, broadly diversified investment portfolio, and the index annuity is a nice compromise for people that want some of the upside of the market, but they don't want to take on any of the downside risks. So it's neither good nor bad, texter. It's just one of the many tools available to financial advisors and many of the one of many strategies available to investors.
All right, 651-461-9226. You can call with your question or you can text it. We have about 4 or 5 minutes left. Texter wrote it in a short bit ago, Bruce, asking your thoughts on bond ladder strategy.
Yeah, so thank you, texter, and thank you, Susie. So bond ladders is something that we do for some clients, and what we mean by a ladder is that we get bonds with a variety of different durations to maturity. We might do the same thing with CDs. So we might build a bond ladder with maturity every 6 months. So we have 6 month bonds or 12 month bonds and 18. We might even build it shorter. We might go 3, 6, 9, 12. So by splitting it up, let's say we build a bond ladder with four different durations, 3 months apart. So we put 25% of our money in bonds that mature in 3 months, 25% of our money in bonds that mature in 6 months, 25% of our money that bonds and mature in 9 months, and 25% in 12 months. So what happens is every 3 months we have a quarter of our money maturing and available. And if we still like bonds, we can renew and buy another, 12-month bond if we want to keep the ladder going. So then we have 3, 6, 9, and 12 again. If interest rates or market conditions change or something happens or our individual circumstances change and we want to do something else with that money after 3 months, we can. But by building a ladder, we always have a liquidity component in the short term as opposed to buying nothing but long-term bonds. And so none of that money is liquid and available without a detrimental impact in the short term. And again, we can do the same thing with CDs. We can have 3, 6, 9, 12, 15 month CDs and build a ladder so that every 3 months you've got a liquidity option. If you want to do something different, you can. If you're happy with the interest rate and you want to renew into another CD, you can. This can be a very effective strategy, and where I've personally done the most work with bond ladders. And again, it's too bad Peg isn't here today because she's the best bond person I've ever known. But where I've usually used these bond ladders, listeners and Susie, is with high net worth clients in a high tax bracket. We might build a municipal bond ladder using individual municipal bonds or maybe even bond funds that are double tax exempt. So the interest rate might not be that high, but if I can avoid state and federal taxes and I'm in a high tax bracket, my net return might be better than something in a taxable investment where I get a better return on investment, but taxes eat up a lot of my gain and my net is lower. So where I've personally done the most work with building a bond ladder is with municipal bonds with my high income, high net worth clients. So for the right circumstances, it can be a great strategy. It's certainly not something that everybody listening today is going to want to go out and do. And Susie, again, I'm keeping a good eye on the clock here. I think we're about out of time.
We are out of time, but some great information today. Maybe you're listening and you jotted down some notes and you have some follow-up questions for Bruce or anyone at Wealth Enhancement. You can email your questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Again, it's yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Or you can call 1-888-6-ADVICE. That's 1-888-6-ADVICE, and someone will get back to you, and you can have a free consultation. Make it a great week. Thanks, Bruce, for everything. Take care.